This is Everything is Workable, a podcast where we examine how every experience, every situation, every moment has an opportunity to work with our mind. I'm your host, Caitlin Hatch, creative polymath and dedicated consumer of wisdom. In this season, I talk to other people about their approach to life and practice. Today's episode is with Sharon Salzberg, one of the founders of the Insight Meditation Society and author of a number of books, including Faith, Loving Kindness, and Love Your Enemies, which she co-authored with Bob Thurman. Sharon Salzberg was the first teacher I had when I first came to Buddhism, so it's quite fitting that she's the first Buddhist teacher I interview for Everything is Workable. She and I discuss loving kindness, the strength and power of love, and how empathy and compassion are things that we can all learn and cultivate over time. If you have a teacher like Sharon in your life, and you'd like them to be a guest for Everything is Workable, you can suggest them through my website, caitlinschatch.com. Also, if you enjoy this episode, please share it far and wide. I really appreciate the support to get it to an ever wider audience. And now, on with the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. I'm not really a morning person, but not that early, really.
I'm not actually technically a morning person in that my brain doesn't function very well early. I just get up early. So I guess we'll get started then. I am a huge fan of your work, by the way.
Thank you.
My psychologist introduced me to Buddhism 9 years ago now, and Faith was one of the very first books that I read. And then I picked up Loving Kindness, The Revolutionary Art of Happiness, and I taught myself to do meditation and metta by reading your book.
Oh, fabulous. It's so great.
Yeah. So I'm very familiar with your work and your teachings, but my audience might not be. And so I thought great starting point would be if you could give a definition for loving kindness.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's great. Well, I'm actually not in the midst. I'm almost at the end of writing another book called Real Love, and I just got a question from the copy editors about loving kindness, and they said, "Is that supposed to be hyphenated, like in between loving and kindness, or is that just one word?" The Merriam-Webster dictionary says it's hyphenated, so it was such a funny moment because I thought, first of all, wow, it's in the Merriam-Webster dictionary.
That's brilliant.
I looked at the hyphen and I thought, nah, you know. So I'm going to get back to them and say I'm used to one word. It's like one thing in a way. It's not really two qualities sort of joined together by a hyphen.
Yeah.
Somehow, you know, it's really one thing. So in Buddhist teaching, in the Buddhist psychology, loving kindness is the common translation of a word. Metta is the word in Pali, the language of the original Buddhist text. It's M-E-T-T-A. Mm-hmm. And it really it's a fine translation, except it's such an odd term. You wouldn't really, say, be in a cafe somewhere and hear the people at the next table talking about loving kindness necessarily. So I've had scholars say to me, just say love. You should just say love. But love is such a complex, complex term.
Yeah.
Like, what in the world do we mean when we say love? So the literal translation is the word friendship. And I even don't tend to use that, because one of the really powerful aspects of loving kindness, and that's difficult to understand, is that what we're cultivating is an inner sense of inclusion and recognition that our lives are connected, all our lives are interconnected. And we're not, it's not a mandate for a certain kind of action, you know. So even friendship seems to me to imply you're going to, like, go get coffee together or something, you know. whereas loving kindness actually doesn't imply any kind of action. You might cultivate a sense of loving kindness for someone and choose never to see them, you know, for other reasons altogether. So I tend to just say connection.
Connection. Oh, wow. There's, like, so many things there that are so great. Because, like, talking about this idea of practice and loving kindness as a practice, but not necessarily something that you do to people, but rather something that you embody.
Mm-hmm.
So one of my favorite quotes And it's a common mantra that I go to, which comes from Elizabeth Mattis Namgyel, who's my formal teacher. She says, the technique is not the practice. And so when it comes to loving kindness or metta, which for me, when I learned to meditate, I kind of broke the rules because they tell you should do shamatha meditation, mindfulness meditation, before you move into any of the other kinds. But I learned, I cut my teeth with metta. There's the whole technique, right? There's a technique of sitting in a particular way in your meditation posture and using phrases that you integrate into the practice and going through set stages of, you know, having loving kindness for yourself. So embodying it for yourself, loved one, and so on. I did an entire episode on this actually. So that's the technique, but could you share what the practice of loving kindness looks like what it means to actually live it, to really embody it day to day outside of a formal session?
Sure. I mean, first I want to say, I think Elizabeth's comment was a very sophisticated teaching, because for many of us, the technique is the important point, you know, in that when you're just starting, for example, I mean, you always have to have, I think, some idea of the principles and the way of being, but it kind of depends on your kind of mind. I think, like, I seem to have a very, having looked at it for 45 years, I seem to have a pretty scattered kind of mind and easily distracted, and also a strong sense of confusion, like, what am I supposed to do, you know? And so for me, or a person with my kind of mind, having a technique, having structure is really a godsend, you know, because I don't have to think, am I doing it right? Am I not doing it right? Is that really love? I don't know. Maybe it's not loving enough, you know, maybe it's got too many conditions. It's like, I can just say the phrases, you know, with wholehearted attention. And it, you know, so coming to an understanding like what Elizabeth is imparting was sort of a later maturation for me. You know, and something very sophisticated. I just wanted to throw that in there for people with minds like mine.
Yeah, I mean, for me as well, when I heard that, it was like a aha moment after 6.5 years of practice, like perfecting techniques. So suddenly be like, oh.
That's right. So, I mean, basically, loving kindness as a practice, it's what I call a stretch in that it's recognizing, which is one of the reasons people often do mindfulness first, so not everybody, really, you're not the only one who switched the order. It's recognizing that we may have certain habitual ways of paying attention, and it's having the desire to make the experiment to stretch, to pay attention differently. So there are some fundamental questions like, how fragmented or how present are we in that attention? So if you're talking to somebody, for example, and the whole time you're thinking about the email you need to write or the people you'd rather be talking to, you're not really listening. You're not really open. You're not really there. And so you're not really going to have a sense of connection. And so the adjustment is in realizing, oh, I'm really fragmented. I'm really scattered. Let me arrive and kind of gather all that attention and energy and simply be there. So we sort of mold how we pay attention in that way. And then another question comes up, like, what do we pay attention to? So, you know, the example I usually use is, if you're the kind of person who, at the end of the day, you look back at yourself through the day almost as though to evaluate yourself. And if you're the kind of person who pretty well only remembers the mistakes you've made and the things you did wrong and, you know, what you could have done better, let's just say, you know, the stretch is in kind of saying, anything else happened today, like any good within me. It's not like wishful thinking or denial or ignoring painful reality. You know, you're not saying I'm perfect and everything went perfectly well, but usually we have such tunnel vision. It's like we key right in on those mistakes and nothing else exists. And so we're just going to stretch actually to a more truthful view of who we are. So what do we pay attention to when looking at ourselves or looking at others? And then there's a very key question that figures very largely in loving kindness practice, which is, who do we pay attention to? You know, who counts, who matters, who do we objectify, who do we ignore, who do we have antipathy for because of, you know, bias or assumption, but mostly who do we have indifference for because they don't count. And so we take a look at that as well, and we modify who we pay attention to, so it's broader, it's more inclusive. It's not just this like inner circle of beings that matter to us. And so that's what we're really doing through the use of the technique, is shifting how we pay attention.
It just makes me think of a quote from Pema Chodron, another thing that I like to turn to, where she's actually, I think she's talking about a teaching by Trigam Trungpa about being genuine, and that being genuine is being honest, that you're not any, not thinking you're any better than you are, but also not thinking you're any worse than you are.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. So when I started to meditate and I was doing metta, I just think this is so interesting, because you're talking about like really showing up for yourself. And that to me is what loving kindness is showing up for yourself, and in doing it for yourself, learning how to do it for other people. So when I was teaching myself using your book, Loving Kindness, I've since learned that when people learn metta, you get taught all of the stages in one go. But when I did it, I thought I couldn't move on to the next stage until I was good with the first one. So I actually only did the first stage of loving kindness for myself for 6 months until I believed it. And so I thought it was interesting. And what it did for me is that I began to realize how I needed to develop the capacity for it. And so I developed some patience around that, where I was like, actually, it takes a while to be able to expand, especially in the West, beyond the stage of even just having loving kindness for yourself, accepting all aspects of yourself as a human, being very complex, and that we're all capable of doing terrible things, but that doesn't make us a terrible person. And and we can kind of show up for ourselves with that. So in expanding the practice in single sittings for each stage over time, I really learned to give myself space and room to adjust. And I learned that it doesn't come easily, so I didn't push myself. But more and more, we seem to live in a world with this expectation that there's quick fixes, right? Like, oh, if you're going to give me this thing, then it's got to resolve a very complex issue with a single answer. And it's a very naive approach. So how do you challenge that mentality? Because I think, like, we all have it, you know, like, I know I want my own quick fixes. And reminding ourselves that actually, for as long as it took me to get entangled, it's probably going to take that long to get disentangled. So what are things that you use to kind of challenge that idea that things need to work instantaneously, or that if they don't work really quickly, they're not worth doing?
Well, I mean, there's also a lot in what you just said. Like, when you say we present the whole sequence of loving kindness, you know, for ourselves, for others, for all beings at once, that's really usually just an overview. It's like way too much to do in any one session. But, you know, so usually I say try to offer loving kindness to yourself and maybe all beings, you know, and then slowly introduce someone else. The reason I don't usually encourage what you did, although you did it very successfully, is because it becomes a project, you know, like people start looking at their calendar like, well, I've been doing it for 40 days, you know, like, where's the love for myself? Yeah. Or, you know, I can't go on until I'm perfect at this. And, you know, so rather than have it be that, you know, I say you can do largely loving kindness for yourself, but, you know, maybe include someone else as well, just so you don't, like, sort of look at the clock that much. But you did it really well, so congratulations.
I think I wasn't looking at the clock or thinking of it that way. I was just thinking, like, I'm going to do this and just set the intention that I really want to believe it.
Yeah, it's great.
Eventually, I did.
I mean, you know, to answer your actual question, It's not easy. You know, we tend to have a culture that's very, very impatient. And, you know, I think one of the best things to do is just talk about that and caution people and have them kind of look for it. And also, one of the tricks with loving kindness practice, I think it's actually relevant to all practice, but it's very, very much highlighted in loving kindness practice, is that you don't necessarily at all see the fruit or the benefit of the practice in the, say, daily period in which you're actually sitting. You know, like maybe you set aside, I don't know, half an hour, 20 minutes, whatever it is each day to sit, you know, and you do that every day for a month and you're doing loving kindness practice. You may not see anything change at the end of that month. You know, while we all long for that great breakthrough experience, like, wow, you know, it was 10:30 on the Tuesday and I loved myself completely, you know, and it was like over. And it's not usually like that. You may see nothing in your formal practice, but the place you will see the changes is the place where it actually counts, which is in your life.
Right.
You know, like, how do you speak to yourself when you've made a mistake? How do you meet a stranger? How sensitive are you to the fears and the hesitations of others? And, you know, how resilient are you when you have to begin again? And you'll see enormous changes.
Yeah.
In that, you know, I did in my own practice, I've guided, you know, thousands of people in just that way. But of those many thousands of people, it's so easy, you know, for someone to be frustrated because we don't tend to look at our lives writ large as the place for the benefit of the practice. We look at that formal period of practice and we think, oh gosh, you know, I'm still getting sleepy or I'm still not sitting there bathed in waves of ecstatic love. You know, like nothing's happening. And, you know, so I say that over and over again because it's so hard for people to believe, but it's really true.
Yeah, it's not about getting a breakthrough experience, but actually the gradual thing. Because it's that you say, like, even over a month, you might not notice a difference. But it's really like, we'll look at it after 6 months. And it might seem minor, but there's something to be said about the sustainability of a baby step versus the sustainability of a giant leap. So one of the things that I really love about loving kindness is this sort of revolutionary aspect of it. And I'm going to be bringing in another word now. I'm going to bring in compassion. And you've already said empathy as well. So these are things that I'm really passionate about. And I've got this refrain at the moment about how radical it is to take care of each other in a world that values a person for how much money they can make rather than simply for being a human being. And compassion being the act of relating with, and loving kindness being the embodiment of love for this humanness, this human quality that we have. It made me realize very recently that one of the barriers that I encounter when I'm speaking to people about it, just sort of like having a moment of like, oh, I see where we're having a disconnect in this conversation, is the belief that compassion or loving kindness or any of those, like empathy, any of that, is mutually exclusive from discernment. It was like a mind-blowing realization because I was like, oh, the assumption is that you can't have discriminating awareness and be empathetic, compassionate, kind. All, like, those are soft things and discernment is a hard thing. And so how do you combat that belief that people seem to have that they might be opening themselves up to harm by embodying loving kindness and compassion?
That too is something I think is best brought out in the open because, even as a prelude to the whole practice, those are interesting reflections to have, you know, because we are taught so many things. Each of us have our personal conditioning, our family conditioning, our cultural conditioning, and, you know, it's usually quite unconscious, and sort of bringing it more to the surface is a very interesting exercise. Like, you know, what do we think will really make us happy? Do we think vengefulness really makes us that happy? You know, and fill your being with a memory of a time you were really vengeful. What's it like? And, you know, what's it like in your body? What's it like in your emotional stream? You know, and, you know, what is strength? And, how alone are we really? You know, we can feel so cut off and so alone and isolated from everyone else, but what's the reality of things? And then, you know, what about love? Is it really that stupid, a quality, you know, that weak? And think of a time somebody loved you. Do you feel pity for them? You know, do you feel like, well, I fooled them, you know? Or what's the sense? And what about compassion? You know, does it have to mean, can you think of a time when someone was compassionate or you were compassionate toward yourself and still you saw what needed the work that needed to be done and you just did it. You went forward to do it with a different spirit, different energy, and just kind of look at that, because I think that's one of our biggest conditionings, that love, qualities like love and kindness and compassion will make us weak and sort of stupid, just like you said, and qualities like vengefulness, you know, will really make us strong, but in many ways it's the opposite. And so and then realizing you're making an experiment. You know, you're seeing what it's like to pay attention differently, first of all, to recognize the humanity of those we normally simply ignore or rigidly oppose, and keep paying attention. You know, what's it like when you give somebody something but you're resentful about having to do it, or you're only doing it because you're in public? And what's it like when you give that same object to somebody wishing them well? And what's it like when you simply look at somebody and wish them well? So probably I would say the two greatest controversies or myths that we face in discussing something like the cultivation of compassion, one is exactly what you described, the idea that it's stupid and you're going to be forced to act in a certain way. And this also comes back to what I was saying earlier, that the cultivation of these qualities is, it completely alters our worldview and our sense of inclusion and how we pay attention. And it doesn't mandate that you go out to dinner with this person you can't stand, you know, or that you give them your money, or you say yes, so you let someone hurt you or hurt somebody else. It doesn't mean anything like that. And so the first great myth is that it'll make us stupid and just complacent. And the second myth is that there's something about the idea that these qualities are trainable that we also tend to have some difficulty with. And I don't know if it's that we so much think of something like compassion as like a gift and you either have it or you don't. And if you don't, you're out of luck. Or we think of it as a kind of immediate emotional response. But in the East, you know, in Eastern psychology, it's definitely believed these qualities are trainable in that they rest in how we pay attention. And we know attention is trainable because that's what meditation practice is.
Yeah.
And so they can be trained.
Oh, gosh. So much there again. This is obviously something that you talk about in your book, Love Your Enemies, which I also really love, co-authored with Bob Thurman. You actually talk about society's tendency to just dismiss kindness as a minor virtue, which, I mean, from a from one viewpoint, I'd be like, well, that's patriarchy for you. But often, if we're pulling back from something as extreme as hatred, and we just even just talk about anger. Anger gets defended because people say that it protects them. And the belief is that having compassion or showing kindness like leaves us wide open to abuse. And I think like the short-sightedness there is like what you're talking about it encompassing everything in the situation. Like compassion is all-encompassing. It's not a one-way thing. So if you're leaving yourself wide open to abuse, then you are in fact not showing compassion for yourself. But there is this belief that aggression is more powerful than loving kindness or empathy or compassion, because this idea that somehow compassion is something like you're doing for someone else. So I'm just going to like come right out with it with the really tough questions that people ask is, when you're talking to somebody about compassion or you're teaching about compassion, you know there's going to be people in the audience who are thinking, what you're telling me that I should feel compassion for my father who was violently abusive, or for the person who abducted and killed my child, or someone who chose to rape me, like that kind of thing. So those are really difficult things that are genuinely painful and justifiably something that a lot of people would be angry about. And I know it's not about denying the anger, but how do you take the approach of like understanding the role that compassion plays with those really extremely painful experiences that people have?
Well, you know, I mean, I think something I always try to emphasize, which comes out of my mindfulness background, and any insight, you know, one engenders there, is that we feel what we feel, you know, and that the point of any kind of practice isn't to denigrate what we're genuinely feeling, even if that's rage or hatred or fear or whatever. We need to be compassionate toward ourselves, first of all. Because if we are, you know, however many years after the act, feeling rage and bitterness and hatred and fear, you know, we're suffering. Mm-hmm. So I'd first of all take the label of bad or wrong or terrible or weak or, you know, whatever off those feelings and just call them states of suffering, which they are. So the first recipient of compassion in that instant is really ourselves. You know, and we have to honor what we're feeling. It's not a question of pretending it's not there, somehow squelching it down. But sometimes, you know, because of their degree, because of their frequency, because of how we relate to them more than anything, you know, those feelings guide our lives, and it's not a great life, you know, because they've defined what's possible for us, how we feel all the time, nearly, how we relate to others, even if they bear no resemblance to, you know, the person who's really hurt us or very little reason, you know, so it's like the limitation and the pain are our own. And so wanting to move away from that isn't a question of, you know, pretending we weren't harmed, you know, or that it's okay. Maybe it's far, far, far from okay what happened, but, you know, still we're the ones bearing the burden of it. And so the rest is an exploration, you know, that we make because of that kind of compassion for ourselves. So I wouldn't even start with compassion. First of all, we don't start with somebody, even as we get to the enemy or, you know, the difficult person, the teaching is not to start with somebody who's like the worst, you know, in our lives. Because it's almost like we're building a little muscle strength, you know. Start with a person at work who annoys you, you know, and then you very slowly make your way over. And you always consider yourself as well. You know, so there are ways of approaching that. And then I don't even usually, you know, contemplate compassion for that person right away. But starting with loving kindness, because they say in the Buddhist psychology that the original intent of the Buddha in teaching loving kindness practice was as an antidote to fear. Mm. You know, so then I look at, you know, my own relationship to loving kindness. If I think of it as the antidote to fear, it makes a lot of sense to try to cultivate it towards these beings in my life who I consider really harmful. Mm-hmm. And if I consider it, you know, if I consider loving kindness as giving in or wishing them to be triumphant or having the chance to hurt me or other people again, then of course it makes no sense. Yeah. And there's no way to want to do it in that circumstance.
Wow, that's it. I'm just having like my own little moment there of like, no wonder I did meta the way I did, because the whole reason I came to meditation and to Buddhism was because I had severe anxiety disorder and had been hospitalized. And you want to talk about like the, you know, the intensity of fear.
Yeah.
Yeah, and loving kindness. Just being able to sit and go, actually being fearful is human.
Yeah, totally.
So when we're talking about those steps of starting to cultivate loving kindness and really embody loving kindness for people outside of us, mm-hmm. and you're moving into the more difficult people who we do have a direct relationship with, we start to move into forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And my understanding of forgiveness has seriously shifted. I did an episode on it where I talked about how forgiveness isn't something that we do for the other person. So it's the same thing like, mm-hmm. I mean, Bob talks about this in Love Your Enemies, where he said, when you start practicing compassion, the first person who benefits is yourself. And when you forgive, it's about like it does have a greater benefit, but there is that sense of a process of healing and that it being good for the heart. And it's not about condoning bad behavior, even said that what the person did, like that they didn't know any better, because sometimes they very well did. But it's that process of, like you said, it's like letting go of those feelings because you feel how they harm you. So you have a passage in Love Your Enemies where you talk about this, and you actually say, I think it's really beautiful the way you put it. You said that we shouldn't be sentimental about forgiveness. And the thread here, again, it's that belief that loving kindness, compassion, empathy, all that is really soft. How would you describe forgiveness? Like, what does that look like when you start to extend loving kindness or compassion or this sense, which I think is encompassed in forgiveness, when you extend that from this place of discernment and care, what does that process look like to you?
I mean, I think it's got a lot of levels depending on how severe the hurt is, you know? When it's not really bad, but nonetheless it's sort of a drag, you know?
Yeah.
I come back to, I don't know if this is in the book or not, but when my Burmese meditation teacher, Sayadaw Upandita, came here to the Insight Meditation Society in 1984, he came to lead a three-month retreat, which I and most of my friends were sitting under his guidance. And, you know, it was a very intensive silent retreat. We were relating to him, but not to anyone else. And because it's my place, you know, I could feel there were certain – and Buddhist monastic – culture is very like precise in the rules, you know, the etiquette and things like that. And I could just tell there were weird things going on, you know, that it wasn't quite working. And for one thing, he kept sleeping in different rooms, and it's just like, it's very complicated, but, you know, and I kept thinking, what's going on? But, and he'd also, he'd never been to the States before. And, you know, we're very different, like in Buddhist teaching altogether, you're always encouraged to ask questions. It's always a good thing, but it's also it's like a culture of respect, you know, for a teacher, for example. And you know, like I have friends who were in the Peace Corps in Thailand and were school teachers, and they would talk about how they'd walk into the classroom and their kids would bow to them. You know, it's just, it's a very respectful culture. And then there we are, you know, and the teacher says something, we say, yeah, show me why, you know, or prove it, or, you know, I mean, I know more than you do, or, you know, whatever we say. And it's not always that polite. So it was a mix of things. So anyway, so this went on for 3 months. At the end of which, when he got up to say goodbye, it was his last, you know, talk, he got up on the platform we have there, and he started out by saying, if I have hurt or harmed you knowingly or unknowingly, I ask your forgiveness. And if you have hurt or harmed me knowingly or unknowingly, I forgive you. And it was like the way of saying goodbye. It was a way of saying, you know what? Things haven't been perfect between us. And were we to meet again, we can meet fresh. Mm. We can see as though for the first time. And it was actually an enormous relief to me, even though I had personally had a tremendous and very positive relationship with him as a teacher. I felt like, oh, you know, like, were I to ever meet him again, he's not going to look at me and think, oh, you're the one who started that center, you know, where they don't even have cheap Buddhist monks. And I wouldn't have to look at him and think, oh, you're the one who came to the West not knowing what you'd find, you know. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. The following year, I went to Burma, and he was my metta teacher for 3 months. And so I think, well, thank goodness, you know. Which, of course, was a huge pivotal turning point in my life. And, you know, and I think, well, thank goodness, you know, I could just go and not have creepy feelings, you know. And and I could really learn from him, and he could really teach me and not feel, you know, whatever one might feel, you know, about having been hosted in an awkward manner. So, you know, so for things that aren't so egregious and so terrible, I come back to that, you know, can I actually do the exercise, you know, of seeing what would it be like to just let go and be willing to start afresh, you know, when there's really deep hurt and there's trauma, there's, you know, real tragedy. Sometimes it's a very, very different thing. And I hesitate personally to use the word forgiveness it'll probably mean I'll end up writing a book on it because it's so hard for me, you know. But I hesitate to use it because I feel like people do mean so many different things, and we confuse it with, as my friend, my colleague with Sylvia Boorstein would say, forgiveness is not amnesia, you know, but we confuse it with amnesia.
Yeah, that's
and
good.
And I feel like I personally have heard amazing stories of forgiveness, and not uncommonly the person will say, you know, this is what happened to me, this is how I came to relate to it, and not uncommonly they'll end that whole thing by saying, but I'll never forgive them. And I'll think, wow, you know, like somebody who was physically very still affected by having been in a terrorist attack, you know, and a lot of pain, you know, he said at one course, and my colleague used the word forgiveness, so he came up to me to complain, and he said, I'll never forgive. And then he said, but what I've learned is absolutely essential. What I've seen is absolutely essential is to learn to stop hating. And I thought, man, I'll take stop hating any day, you know. That sounds pretty good to me, you know, when you've been through something like that every day, you know, you feel the effects of it, it's very real for you. And I think stop hating is kind of enough, you know.
Yeah.
And whatever sort of magical association he had with the word forgiveness, I think is really something extra.
Yeah, I think I was meeting people with their definitions of a word and understanding that it's not universal how we understand something. So if we're going to have a conversation, because for me, stop hating, I'll be like, yeah, that sounds like forgiveness to me. But you don't want to call it that. So that's cool. I respect that you don't want to call it that. And I get it, because I think we have a very warped idea of forgiveness. And I liken it to the example of how we teach it so often with children. It's like, say, one kid takes a toy away from another, and then, you know, to berate them, you like say, give the toy back and say you're sorry. And they say, I'm sorry, and they resent it. And then the child who gets the toy back is told, now you have to forgive them. And so it's a contract, and it's not, there's nothing there. Both children are resentful of the situation.
Right.
Yeah, it does nothing to really heal. And I think that's like letting go of hate is a healing process. So whatever you want to call it, it's about, I appreciate all the questions you asked earlier when you're talking about, like, does it feel good to be vengeful? Yeah. How does that feel? And that's really what it is it's like asking those questions, whatever you want to call embodying loving kindness or moving into a space of love and compassion and empathy. It's asking ourselves those questions, like, does it feel good? Does it serve for me to hold on to anger, rage, or any of those? I always finish off by asking people to share recommendations, where you would recommend people look, things that they could listen to or read, or teachers that you have found valuable in your life, just anything that you think could be beneficial as signposts for people who want to learn more about loving kindness and metta and possibly what you do.
Yeah, well, I am just about finished with this other book, so I've been dwelling in the world of love. This time I'm calling it Love, which will be called Real Love, and it's coming out in June 6th, I think. Most of my learning in this whole process has come from other people. You know, I would gather these groups, and the book is divided in three sections: love for oneself, love for an other, whoever that happens to be, and then love for all beings. And you know, I gather these groups, and we would just talk about love. And so, as an example, I was in the very first group I did. This guy raised his hand, and he said, you know, most people think of a good relationship as 50-50. My dog and I, we're 100-100. I love that. And so my book was due last time. I was quite late with it. But last deadline was August 1st and the night of July 31st. I was about to press send, and I thought, I just had this flash, like, did that story make it in the book? And I looked, and it had not. So I quickly put it in, and then I pressed send, you know. So, and sometimes it's not even personal in terms of a dog, you know, it's our love for life. And I just learned such a huge amount from from so many people, so I'm still sort of residing in that.
So it's just like asking people about their definition of love, because you're right, it's a big word.
Yeah. Another example, which was the last group that I did, which was actually here in Barrie, which was, you know, with like people who are on staff at the Insight Meditation Society and in the community. And somebody said to me what I think is actually one of the pivotal points of the book, which I had not even considered. He said, you know, all my life I've been taught that liking somebody is a very ordinary, almost to be expected kind of thing. And loving someone is a supreme, rare, rare, rare accomplishment. And he said, you're reversing them. You're saying we can love a whole lot of people we don't even like. And I looked at him and I said, oh my God, you're right. You know, like, that's what the book's about.
Well, that sounds really powerful. I'm very excited to read this book when it comes out. Add it to my Dharma list. Brilliant. This has been wonderful. Thank you so much for taking the time to come chat.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening. To find out more about Sharon and the work that she does, you can visit SharonSalzberg.com. Her newest book, called Real Love, The Art of Mindful Connection, will be out on June 6th of this year. It's already available for pre-order through Amazon. To find out more about what I do, visit CaitlinSCHatch.com, where you can sign up to get my monthly wrap-up email and leave a tip to help support the show. Also, if you enjoyed this episode, you would probably also enjoy Being the Change, an episode from season 2 of Everything is Workable, about meta practice. Thank you to Dexter Britton for composing the fantastic music accompanying this and the previous 2 seasons of Everything is Workable.